From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz. Today we'll be speaking with Locke Hughes about health wearables and all the latest devices that can help track your sleep, your heart rate, your biking prowess, and even your fertility. Be sure to listen in if you're a dedicated biohacker. There are new features emerging soon that you'll want to know about.
Or even if you're not a dedicated biohacker, because I'm not, and I love this stuff. Then we'll speak with Sally Tauber and Kendra Wyckoff from the Peace House about its history here in Park City and the invaluable support it provides for local families in crisis from abuse and domestic violence. That's all coming up next on The Mountain Life. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words. Oh, and one other quick blurb we have at the bottom of the hour. We'll be joined very briefly by Ron Jackenthal, founder of Live Like Sam. And the three of us will chat briefly about a new segment coming up here on The Mountain Life called Resilient Youth. And it starts next week. That's all coming up. Stay with us.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Well, fitness trackers, or more accurately, health wearables, are everywhere, and they can track everything. They're convenient, interesting, and, well, fun. For the biohackers among us, or the not biohackers, just the interested parties, fitness trackers offer an exciting host of metrics by which one can gauge progress with fitness goals or just get daily insights on the way your body's functioning.
Our guest today is Park City local Locke Hughes. She's a seasoned journalist with over 15 years of experience focusing on the wellness industry as a contributor to media outlets such as Oprah Magazine, Women's Day, Shape, and NBC News. Locke is now the head of content at Aura, one of the major health wearable companies. You know, it's that ring that everyone seems to have. Locke Hughes, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. Excited to be here.
Well, I was always a person who's been interested in how the body works, and I pay real close attention to the various things going on in my body, but I don't think that I've ever had the kind of window into insights that I have in the last year and a half that I've been wearing this Aura. And what do you find is bringing most people to this new age of seeing how their body works through a device?
It is. It's amazing. I love to hear that you've been an Aura member for a year and a half. I've been there for about 3 years, and I've learned so much about my body as well. And that's really our mission, is to give everybody a voice, help you tune into the signals that your body is telling you. And I think most people know Aura as a sleep tracker. That's sort of where we started. That's really our basis, our expertise. And we're incredibly accurate when it comes to sleep. We call it a sleep lab on your finger. And since then, we've been around for a little over a decade now, and we've really expanded into all different pillars of health. We do a lot of women's health. We do cycle tracking, fertility, heart health. It can tell you how well your heart is aging compared to your biological age. We track activity. We recently released some metabolic health features, so helping you understand what you're eating and how that impacts your body as well.
Oh, that is so exciting.
Yes.
And I know that you particularly have an interest in sleep. What kinds of things can you track or get insights into with your sleep?
Yeah, so in the morning, Aura will tell you everything about your sleep. It will tell you how long you slept in each stage of sleep, from REM to deep sleep to light sleep. It tells you your resting heart rate and your heart rate variability, or HRV, which has become, I think, a really popular metric. And then we'll give you a sleep score and also a readiness score, so sort of how primed your body is to take on the day. I think for me, one of the most interesting things I've learned is how the quality of sleep matters even more than the quantity of sleep, right? Like, I can spend, you know, 8-9 hours in bed and get really poor quality sleep, but if I get even 7 hours of sleep, but a lot of that restorative deep sleep, I feel pretty good. And there's a lot of things you can do to enhance your deep sleep, like making sure you're not eating too close to bed, obviously, sadly, skipping alcohol right before bed, and getting exercise during the day.
And you know what, that's one of the interesting things, is that all of the trackers and their insights bring great feedback to you, but I do like the tone that is used with Aura. It's not scolding, it's not guilt driven. It seems to be about like, hey, we're all in this together. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how conscious that is, but it is really a friendly kind of vibe.
Yeah, that compassionate tone is definitely intentional. We try to, let people know that it's okay if you didn't get a great night's sleep. Just, you know, maybe take it easier today. Listen to your body. Maybe sneak in a nap if you can. And so we definitely try to take that non-judgmental approach.
As the head of content, Locke, are you the person that comes up with that, you know, more compassionate messaging? Oh, we should say this, not that.
No, I wish. The people who write the in-app copy is a little different than my team. But I think that they do a great job. And another interesting thing is we're actually a Finnish company. So that team is actually in Finland. And I think that we do bring in that, you know, sort of Nordic approach to life that's all about balance. It's a little bit less hard charging than the American tone of voice might take. So I think that's another fun fact about Aura.
That is a fun fact. Well, Park City has no shortage of interesting people. And Locke Hughes, I think this is so cool that you live right here in Park City. And then, as you said, Aura is a Finnish company. I would love to hear how you became involved with it. And then also a little bit about the history the genesis of Aura.
Yeah. So, like I said, we started in Finland, and Finland is a hotbed for technology, turns out. We were founded by a group of entrepreneurs who had also worked at Nokia, was founded there, and Polar, if anyone uses the Polar wearables. And, you know, we've since expanded into the global market. A lot of our company is based in the U.S. now, but we're pretty half and half between Europe and the U.S. now. And right. I've been involved for about 3 years, and I did start out as a health writer. I've written, you know, for different publications. I've also written a book about sleep, kind of coincidentally, before I came to Aura. So that was kind of my initial interest. And I feel, you know, it's been really exciting. It's been a wild ride here at Aura, but it's exciting to see it on a lot more people's fingers. I mean, we're all wearing one right now. It's fun to kind of make that connection too with just people that you see out in public. I sat next to someone on the plane who had one the other day, and everyone loves to talk about their scores, and everyone's pretty excited to talk about what their Aura has taught them.
Yeah. Okay, so last night I was having dinner with four girlfriends, and we all had varying thoughts. It was a conversation. There might have been a little argument about wearable devices, how accurate they are, which ones are better, which ones, you know, and the different features. And I think it's interesting, and I'd love to hear your take on this. You know, what Aura is known for being particularly accurate. I feel it's so accurate on sleep. And there are other wearables and apps and things that may be a little more accurate on different things. Like they highlight different things.
Totally. For sure. I think that wearable technology has gotten so accurate over the last few years. So I think you really can't go wrong. Like I said, we started with sleep. So a lot of peer-reviewed third-party research has shown us to be the more accurate wearable when it comes to sleep. Like I said, those heart rate variability, I think we're 98 to 99% accurate compared to a in-office like clinical test. We are as accurate as a polysomnography exam, which is that crazy sleep test when you have to go in somewhere and wear electrodes hooked up to your head and your chest and your arms, which I've actually done.
It's as accurate as those sleep
tests?
About
as accurate, yes.
Wow, that's extraordinary.
Yes, and I think the benefit of a wearable is that you take it home with you. You can wear it every night, so it really shows your trends over time versus something like a sleep test in a lab. That's just one night of sleep and probably a pretty uncomfortable night of sleep. And yeah, I think we're really focusing on activity these days. We're trying to get more accurate in terms of, identifying how quickly you ran, what's called running splits. We are partnering with a lot of different fitness and movement partners to make sure that we're able to integrate people's data if they're wearing, say, or if they're using Strava or any sort of other wearable. You can add that info into Aura. And a lot of people wear an Apple Watch at the same time as an Aura ring. I think some people do appreciate that you can get that real-time feedback and just, you know, check what the screen says on your wrist. But it's also an advantage of Aura, I think, that we don't give you another screen to look at. Like, you can kind of check in whenever you'd like to. It's not yelling at you all day long like some other wearables, but it really depends. I think, you know, there's one called Whoop that a lot of athletes turn to because it kind of has that more aggressive tone, I guess, you know, like, you know, encouraging you to get up and work out. So it really depends on what you're looking for, but I would say our sweet spot and like our historical expertise has been in that sleep and recovery space. And we also have ventured into women's health, like I mentioned, and we can tell women their fertile window or the 5 or 6 days per month when they are most likely to conceive. And we've done peer-reviewed third-party research on that, and it is more accurate than the calendar tracking method. So yeah, I think the advancements have been pretty incredible. It kind of just depends on what you're looking for.
It really is. I wish it had been around back in the when we were having kids, because the old-fashioned way of doing your temperature every morning and the accuracy that you have to get to really make that work is very difficult, and this makes it just seamless. Let's talk a little bit about heart health. Years ago, I did a sprint triathlon, and I'm going to milk it the rest of my life. But Sally Edwards, who was this big triathlete, she said that the way she kept track of her health and making sure she wasn't overtraining was by taking her resting heart rate before she got out of bed every morning. And when it was a little elevated, it told her that her body was needing a little extra recovery time. And this is kind of known knowledge now, but it was fairly groundbreaking at the time. And so I was like, oh, wow, I'm going to totally do that. And I did. But it was it was just so awkward.
Did you like actually touch your pulse?
Yes, and I'm looking and I'm trying, then I'm doing it the 6 second one times. It's just not exact enough. And so I love that feature of just knowing what my lowest resting heart rate was during my sleep. And if it is a little elevated, to know that, you know, maybe take it easy or be a little extra conscious of hydration, these kind of things. But let's talk a little bit about the other things, the heart rate variation and some of these other features that have to do with heart health.
Totally. Yeah. The resting heart rate is definitely a key metric. But I think HRV or heart rate variability has become also a really key metric for a lot of folks. And that actually gives you insight into how your nervous system is regulated. So a lot of people use that now, I think probably even a little bit more so than resting heart rate, to know how well you've recovered. We have something called HRV balance, which gives you a sense of how your HRV, how stable it's been over the last couple of weeks. And actually, I got a message today that says, like, you know, it looks like you've been recovering well. Maybe today is a good day to go get them, you know? And so I think HRV is an interesting metric. It actually is the variation between each heartbeat, and it essentially, if it's a little bit lower than usual, it's a sign that your body is under stress or strain of some sort. And when it's a little bit higher than usual, it's a sign that you've recovered well and your nervous system is regulated. So I think that's a really interesting metric in addition to resting heart rate.
Yeah. Well, I was reading an article yesterday about what they're calling a sixth sense of interoception, which is the understanding and conscious relationship between the way our body is functioning and our mind, and how aware we are of how our body's functioning. It's a little bit weird, but it has to do with balance and proprioception, but also all kinds of things with anxiety. And I was just thinking that these aren't just for athletes. You know, these kind of fitness wearables, you know, the word is fitness because these are probably the drivers of the market in a lot of ways, but my Aura Ring's more likely to just tell me, hey, you've been sitting for a while, time to get up and stretch your legs. Does that sound good? It's just a lifestyle thing. It's such an interesting window into knowing yourself better and knowing your body. Mm-hmm. Can we talk a little bit about readiness scores? Mm-hmm. I think those are really cool to start the day. And what does that mean?
Oh, yeah. It kind of, you know, we don't want, it's funny, it's meant to give your body a voice, kind of listen to what your body's telling you, but I think some people maybe do get a little obsessed with it. but yeah, it's important to have that body literacy. That's a term we use a lot. It's like knowing how to read your body's signals. We don't want you to rely on the stats like so obsessively, but the stats are cool. It's great to have that crown that pops up when you have I think it's 85 or above readiness, like I had this morning.
Nice.
We take into account, like I mentioned, your HRV balance, your resting heart rate, your sleep from the night before, and also how active you've been over the last few days. For example, if you did a big workout, if you, you know, did a massive mountain bike ride or a huge hike, it might be a little bit lower just to remind you to maybe take it a little bit easier that day. If you haven't been doing a lot of exercise, it will also take that into account and say, you know, maybe today is a good day to get some steps in. It's also interesting that we adapt your activity goal of the day to coordinate with your readiness. So if your readiness is a little bit on the lower side, we might tell you to take or suggest that you take 8,500 steps rather than 12,000 steps. So it kind of enables you to tune into what your body's telling you and kind of adjust your routine for that day.
Nice. Mm.
When you were talking about fertility, I have a new daughter-in-law, and I was picturing giving her an Oura ring as a gift. And I know exactly what she would think is oh, what you, is oh. this like trying to get right. some grandkids going?
Right.
But I'm curious. So I know that, you know, obviously it's your temperature, and what else do those, like, heart rate variability, what else plays into fertility that a wearable device could tell us?
That's a great question, and I am not a scientist, so I'm not going to claim to know all of the science behind it. But like you said, body temperature is the really main trend, and it's really crazy. You know, now that I'm in my 30s, I finally understand that a woman's body goes through these really distinct phases throughout every month, and your body temperature is raised during the first half of the month, and then ovulation occurs, and then it drops. So I would say that your body's temperature trends are probably the main metric that we use, but we also do use resting heart rate and HRV. Those also follow distinct patterns throughout the month. And so our you know, brilliant scientists have created a machine learning algorithm that is able to kind of predict when ovulation happens. And you also don't have to opt in to those cycle tracking features. So it's kind of an obviously, you know, a lot of our audience is male, but I think for women, it can just give you that that extra knowledge and that body literacy of knowing what your body's going through. And it's pretty incredible how under-talked about it has been, I think, for women. And I think it's great that we're, at least no matter what your goals are, whether you're trying to conceive or not, it's just really helpful to know those patterns that your body is going through every day,
yeah.
every month.
Yeah, so interesting. Let me reintroduce you. We're speaking with Locke Hughes, and she's a local Parkite, mm-hmm. and she is the head of content for Oura Ring, O-U-R-A. Wait, is that how the Finnish say it? Oh,
they kind of say Oura. Like Oura. Yes, exactly. You do have some Finnish friends.
I got some Scandinavian roots.
Okay,
back
there you go.
My DNA. Mm-hmm. So, of course, wearable devices are never going to replace professional medical care. However, they can, you know, if you achieve this body literacy, you're going to know when things are not right with your body. And someone very close to me was at his cardiologist appointment, and the cardiologist suggested that he does a sleep study. And I was thinking maybe just an Oura ring to get, you know, just become more familiar with it. And then also maybe more familiar with what's going on with your heart and noticing trends. You mm-hmm. have some crazy stories about what you guys hear, feedback from your
totally.
Wearable device wearers.
Yes, absolutely. We get amazing stories. I would say if not, you know, maybe not daily, but weekly, we get a few amazing stories about, you know, Oura alerted me to XYZ, and then I went to the doctor or went to the ER even, and I was alerted, you know, ahead of time that I was having a silent heart attack or something like mm-hmm. that. There's just an amazing story that kind of went viral and made the rounds of a young woman who was receiving an alert from her Oura ring that her body was under what we call major signs of strain. And she was getting this for days on end and wasn't really sure what was going on. And that prompted her to go to her doctor. And turns out she had cancer. So she was able to get the help she needed with that early detection. We just got one in this week. A woman wrote in and said, my husband's Oura ring said he was having major signs of strain on the body. His heart rate was elevated. HRV had plummeted. His body temperature was high. And he felt so off that he went to the emergency room just to check in. And he ended up having a silent heart attack the night prior. And one of his arteries was almost completely blocked. And he had to get a stent put in to get the blood flow back. And this person says that without those aura stats, I don't think he would have gone in and gotten seen. So like you said, it's not necessarily that we are a replacement for a medical professional by any means, but it does help you kind of alert to those signs that something is straining your body. And these stories are just incredible. And it feels, you know, it's we're certainly not a nonprofit, but we are, you know, helping people, I think, identify really important health issues early on.
Well, I think there are so many interesting things that it's doing right now, but there's always the next thing around the corner. What do you imagine that a fitness wearable might be able to do in 2 years or 5 years or 10 years? Or what would you like to see it be able to do?
That's a great question. And I feel like the future is here almost. It's just amazing what we've been able to do in just a few years. I think a really amazing new feature that just came out this month is metabolic health. And so we, with the snap of a photo with your phone, Aura can identify the major macronutrients on your plate, help you identify the processing level of your food, and sort of give you guidance about what you're eating. And I think that is a really fascinating new area of health. It's sort of that 360 approach to health. It's not just sleep, it's not just activity, it's not just stress. It's also, of course, what you're eating is very important. And if you want even more data for the biohackers among us, you can get what's called a glucose biosensor, and that goes in the back of your upper arm, and it can monitor your glucose levels throughout the day. And it also, because it integrates with Aura, shows you how your stress affects your glucose levels, how a bad night's sleep might affect your glucose levels, or what happens after you do a hard workout. So sort of how all of those elements are intertwined. So I think that's for sure the future.
Those are available now.
Yes, they're rolling out now.
Yeah. Wow.
And so with the glucose biosensor, you do have to purchase the biosensor through Aura. And you know, I haven't done it yet personally, but I'm interested. And yeah, I think it'll be a fascinating way to just, again, learn more about your body. Not that you have to track your glucose levels for the rest of your life, but I think it's kind of a fun N of one experiment, as we like to say, just to learn more about your body and how your habits affect your health.
Absolutely. Well, we've been talking with Locke Hughes today about fitness wearables and the various ways that they can bring you insights into how your own body is functioning, not only just by the day, but over time. And it's seeing those trends and reports is really fascinating. We are so happy to hear about these things, and I love my Aura, and I wear it all the time. And
This is
not an ad, and we are definitely acknowledging there are many wearables out there that are doing great things, but because we happen to have experience with this one, we're really glad to have you. Thank you so much for being with us on The Mountain Life this morning.
Of course. Thank you both so much for having me.
Thanks, Locke. I just wanted to add that we are interviewing famous mountain bike racer and gravel bike racer Keegan Swenson, I don't know, last year sometime. And I asked him about wearables. And this is for the person to give permission that we don't all need these, and only some of us will want them. But he said, it doesn't matter how my readiness or anything like that, because it's my job to go out and train every single day. So I'm going to train no matter what. So his comment was like, no, I don't use these, and I'm going to go out no matter what.
Right.
Ready or not. So.
Right, ready or not.
I just thought I would make that comment.
Love that.
Again, you know, we're not here to promote anything.
I'm going to look at that screen and let it tell me, should I go hard or should I chill today?
I know. I mean, I get up early and I look at it, and if I have a bad sleep score, I make myself stay in bed. Mm-hmm. And I've gotten so much more sleep as a result. So it's so
That's
fun.
Great.
All right.
Love to hear it.
Yes, thank you again.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz. Here on The Mountain Life, we try to highlight the most current and important health-related topics of our time. One of these is a topic we think is important enough to turn into a monthly segment.
So we've partnered with Live Like Sam to focus on what and who we believe are the most important people in our society, youth, and specifically what we can all do to help our young people become resilient youth, which is the name of our monthly segment. And joining us now to tell us more is Ron Jackenthal, the founder of Live Like Sam. Hi, Ron.
Hi, Lynn. Hi, Mary Beth. As our community's leading nonprofit focused on youth well-being and prevention, we see every day how critical resilience is in the lives of young people. With suicide, overdose, and substance misuse on the rise, this segment explores how resilience, a teachable, life-changing skill, can help equip the next generation to lead healthier and more hopeful lives.
I think it's really easy to fall into the trap of only noticing the negative coverage about what's going on with today's young people. There are so many valid concerns about social isolation, online dangers, substance abuse, mental health, even how AI will change the way they think. But I also believe there's a lot to celebrate and admire about the way young people are navigating life and the innovative programs and caring professionals that offer new ways to help them through their challenges. I guess my hope with the Resilient Youth Series is to highlight those opportunities, strategies, and victories that empower young people and help them continue on with some great accomplishments as we more fully recognize their gifts and efforts.
Great. We look forward to talking to our youth, to experts in the field, to parents. If you have any ideas for show episodes, please email us at themountainlife@kpcw.org, or you can email Ron Jackenthal, ron@livelikesam.org. Join us for Resilient Youth. It's the final Wednesday of each month at 9 a.m. And Live Like Sam is a financial supporter of KPCW. Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
An estimated 1.3 million women are victims of physical assault by an intimate partner every year in the U.S. And it's reported that more than 25% of all women will have experienced domestic violence in their lifetime. Domestic abuse is far more widespread than most people realize, and affects people of every socioeconomic background and education level.
But fortunately, there are people working hard to provide support and resources to individuals and families in crisis. The Peace House is one of Park City's oldest nonprofit institutions, founded almost 30 years ago to respond to those in danger due to domestic violence. Today, we're speaking with Kendra Wyckoff, Executive Director of Peace House, about what Peace House does, why it's so important, and how each of us can do our part to help those in crisis in our community. Kendra, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you both.
Well, let's start a little bit. I think Peace House is an institution in town, and it's so well respected and so appreciated for everything it does. How did it get started? What was its impetus?
Right. Well, thank you so much for those compliments. We work really hard to be one of those institutions that people can trust. Mm-hmm. You know, many years ago, back in the early 90s, tragically, there were two deaths in our community. Many people probably are familiar with Natalie Noble and her murder because it was very public at the local grocery store. And another murder that happened in a home here in the community. And women got together and said, you know, we really need to figure out how we can support women who are in situations that are experiencing domestic violence and find safe places for them. So they created this network, essentially, to help women working alongside the police department, because at the time, there was no facility, there was no physical space. And although the YWCA was down in Salt Lake City and is a great resource, there were some pretty significant barriers, whether that was transportation, community support, people feeling like maybe they couldn't take their children there and out of community. So what happened is we had these incredible community leaders that started with a group of, you know, church ladies who were very, very motivated to ensure that women and children had a safe place. And they started the Domestic Peace Task Force, and they worked alongside some really incredible community leaders like Bob Wells. And they were able to secure a small piece of land across from the city hall and build the first Peace House emergency shelter. And that opened in 1995.
Wow.
Yeah, it's amazing.
D- Do you have any, and this, I don't expect you to know the numbers right off of your head, but do you have any idea how many people have been helped over the years by Peace House?
Thousands upon thousands.
Really?
Yes, really. I mean, at this point in time, you know, we are touching the lives of people with direct intervention services. These are people who are coming to us, whether it be for shelter, case management, counseling, legal advocacy. You know, we're seeing 500 to 600 people on an annual basis, and then we touch thousands of other lives through our prevention education efforts. You know, the hope in those efforts is that we can get upstream on these issues in our community, we can teach healthy relationships, we can build skill sets that allow our community members to intervene in unsafe situations in the safest way possible to potentially prevent violence and abuse from happening in the first place. And really, we touch thousands of people, sometimes up to 20,000 people a year, whether it's in those formal community education spaces, within the schools, or reaching out in community where we're tabling and connecting with families on a one-on-one basis.
Mm. Some of the most shocking and sort of illuminating aspects of what you all do is we talked about in the intro, which is that I think a lot of people don't realize that it affects, you know, it's across the board, every socioeconomic level, every education level. And if I'm not mistaken, those two deaths that happened in the 90s were, you know, maybe not people that you would expect to be in this, you know, milieu of domestic abuse. Can you talk a little bit more about that, about, you know, just that fact?
Right, right. I think that people, if you haven't experienced it or know someone who's experienced it, you can be shielded from the reality. But what we know and what we see and what we have happen here in community is that every socioeconomic group, every education level, every racial, ethnic background, you know, gender identity, sexual orientation is very much touched by this issue. These are issues that have been historically very private, right? Happening behind the closed doors of our homes. We didn't talk about what was happening within our families. And we have done a lot of work to heighten the conversation in community to say, these have lasting impacts, not just on those individual families, but it has a tremendous ripple effect. The children in your child's classroom, there are kids who are affected by this issue. There are teachers, healthcare professionals that you are seeing on a daily basis who are affected by this issue. The person that you check out at the grocery store and you probably have wonderful conversations with every single day may be affected by this issue. I can tell you, I had a really eye-opening experience, and I've done this work for 25 years, so I'm very familiar with the prevalence in our state. And earlier, Lynn, you said 1 in 4 nationally. Utah has a higher average. It's 1 in 3. Oof. So 33% of women in Utah will or have experienced domestic violence in their lifetime. But what I want to share with you is just my kind of day-to-day interactions in the community that I had a couple of weeks ago, and I had the opportunity to be in community and talk with women who were connected to different, you know, entities. I went into businesses, and I just happened to, in those spaces, mention that I work at a nonprofit, and people would say to me, "Where do you work?" And I said, "I work at Peace House." I had within 1 week 10 women disclosed to me in our community whether they had received services, that they had been a survivor of domestic violence. And I think that's incredibly impactful because, as you said earlier, people don't realize that these are your neighbors. They're the people you're going to church with. They're the people you work with. This is the reality. And because for so long it's been a private matter, we've had so much social stigma around these issues and shame, we just haven't created space to have these conversations. And we're working hard to change that narrative here in this community.
This seems like a strange question, but you know, when I was a young kid, I got spanked every now and again, and now spanking is considered abuse, right? I mean, there may be some debate about that.
Yeah.
But when we take this into domestic violence, do people not recognize? Well, maybe the question is just what construes domestic violence?
No, I think that's a great question. You know, we really, I think for folks, what resonates is physical abuse, right? When you see somebody with a black eye or they show up in the hospital emergency room with severe injuries, then people go, that's domestic violence. Domestic violence is so much more complicated and complex. It's about power and control. It's one person who's in the relationship who has power and control over the other significant person and often the children in the family unit. And what that manifests into is so many different types of tactics, from emotional abuse, verbal abuse, financial abuse, spiritual abuse, isolation. And a lot of those tactics are used to really establish control in the relationship. And then the physical and sexual abuse or the threats of abuse are used to reinforce it. So, for example, if you have someone who is in a very controlling relationship and their partner's monitoring their cell phone, who are you talking to? I told you that your family doesn't really care about us, and so I don't want you talking to your mom. I saw that you were talking to your mom the other day. And then they reinforce that with some sort of like physical violence or threat of violence. That survivor is going to be even more isolated, right? Because they're going to make a decision to, I want to avoid that abuse. I want to not have this experience again. So I'm going to continue to do what my partner is asking me to do, which is to isolate me, essentially. That's just one kind of simplistic example, but there are so many examples, and survivors are experiencing all of this. It's not just one tactic. It's many tactics. The other thing is that you can be a victim of abuse and never experience physical or sexual abuse. And that's really important for people to understand, that Peace House is not just here for folks who are in a situation where they've experienced physical or sexual abuse. If you're experiencing emotional abuse, reach out to Peace House so that we can provide you with resources, so that you can ask questions, so that you can learn about the dynamics of domestic violence. Again, we have an interest in not just intervening, you know, when people are in crisis, but in those earlier opportunities in relationships so that we can prevent violence in the first place.
I think it's pretty clear. We have an idea in our minds about what the physical abuse looks like. But is there a pattern to the way abuse, domestic abuse of emotional, financial, other kinds unfolds in a marriage, in a relationship, that you could watch for warning signs?
Yeah, I think red flags, you know, of unhealthy relationships are things that we talk about often in community. I think when folks are, you know, getting into a relationship early on, nobody is looking for an abusive relationship. Nobody, and I'll tell you, abusive partners are not using violence at the, you know, on the first date, right? They're not. Oftentimes, the tactics that they use look like things like love bombing. Like, I want to spend so much time with you. I don't want you to spend time with your friends. I want you to spend more time with me. I don't want you to work anymore because I want to take care of you. And I want to do these things so that I can cut off your support systems and your community so that I can further isolate you and control you. If you're in a relationship and you're experiencing really controlling behavior, jealousy, excessive jealousy, people are human, they're going to get jealous. Excessive jealousy, it's not normal to be having your partner go through your phone to see who you're talking to. That's not normal, right? That's not a sign of a healthy relationship. That's an example there. If somebody's monitoring who you're spending time with, how long you're gone, somebody's cutting off your access to finances and they control the finances in the household or in the relationship. You know, they're asking you to give up the things that you care about, that give you joy, whether that be hobbies, your employment, your friendships, your relationships. Those are all red flags there.
And is there, say, I know a lot of young women in my life, and I would love to be able to give them some kind of tipping point. Like, I mean, everybody has had maybe a relationship where somebody just is really all about you. And it's kind of flattering at the beginning, right? You're like, oh my gosh, this person is so into me. And they just want to do all these things for me. And it feels like you are being taken care of for a minute as a woman. You know, that's kind of a anachronistic, but fun little thing from time to time. But at what, how can you gauge, is there some kind of internal monitor that we could use to notice when this is no longer working? And then can you reset that balance, or is it something that you probably are just going to have to leave that relationship?
Yeah, those are great questions. I think those are really...
I only gave you like 10 questions in there, sorry.
And they're complicated questions,
they are, yes.
You know, unfortunately, it's not a very clear sort of black and white issue, right? There's a huge gray area in just the fact that humans are messy. What I say is if something is happening in your relationship and you go, that made me uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. I didn't really like that. Mm-hmm. It's okay to reflect on that and have questions about it. It's okay to talk to somebody in your support system about that. Is that normal? You know, is that leading down a path of something to something else? Obviously, any physical violence or abuse, sexual coercion and abuse, those are like, you know, those are huge, huge red flags and very damaging and create a lot of harm. If those things are happening in your relationship, that is an unsafe relationship. If you're experiencing some controlling behavior from your partner and you're starting to ask yourself, what is this about? And I'm feeling uncomfortable and I don't like this. This person is kind of, you know, cutting me off from the things that I enjoy in life. It's important to be asking those questions. Peace House is a great place where you can reach out. You can call our helpline. You can talk with somebody confidentially and anonymously. You don't even have to share your name. So you can call and say, I'm just experiencing these things. If Peace House isn't the right resource, have somebody in your support circle who can be that person that you can talk to and ask questions about this. And I think these are conversations that we need to be having earlier on in the lifespan, right? We should be talking about healthy relationships with children from the earliest stages. Mm-hmm. And healthy relationships is not a taboo subject when you're in kindergarten, because friendships are healthy relationships. Not experiencing bullying is a healthy relationship, mm-hmm. right? So we want to start there. If we build those boundaries in place that it's okay to set boundaries, if something makes you uncomfortable and you don't like what you're experiencing, to say, I don't like that, and no. We start early on, we can build those into relationships as they grow, as adolescents, as adults. Unfortunately, again, because this has been such a private issue, we don't talk about these things, right? So where do we learn about relationships?
Modeling.
Modeling. Sometimes our friends, in our homes, our parents. And so when we see things, we normalize that and think, well, that's just how relationships are. Abusive relationships are unhealthy, unsafe relationships. And the more that we can do to educate people about how to identify those and to reach out for help. And I think you asked a really important question, and that's part of the work that we can do too at Peace House. We've had survivors come to us who say, I'm experiencing emotional abuse. I think that's what this is. And they've been able to get the support that they need. They may say, I'm not feeling like I need to come to shelter, but I want to talk to a counselor. I want to set some boundaries with my partner. I want to understand how to do that in a healthy way for myself and support and encourage my partner to get the help that they need too. And so we've seen people come to us in those earlier stages, and we can help in those earlier stages. We work with survivors only, but we can provide information about resources for somebody who may be using abusive tactics where they can also get help.
We're speaking with Kendra Wyckoff. She's the executive director of Peace House. And I love, Kendra, that we're going so deep into this conversation. We talk to you a lot here, quite often at KPCW, about things going on with Peace House, and you're on the local news hour quite often. I'm happy that we have the time to go a little bit deeper.
Yes, me too.
And not to beat this statistic to death, but... you know, 25% of all women will have experienced domestic violence in their lifetime. In Utah, that's higher, you said, 33%. Are things like verbal abuse, like controlling, like, are those counted into that 33% or 25% nationally? I'm just trying to get a really clear idea.
Well, it depends on the survey. Okay. The survey here in Utah, yes, we do include things like verbal, emotional abuse. But again, what we see with survivors is that a person is often not just experiencing one type of abuse, right? They're experiencing multiple types of abuse. And all of those things that we talked about that are the non-criminal abusive tactics are the precursors for the violence.
And that's my next question. Is there any ability to also, you know, is there any statistic that says if you're getting, you know, controlled and if there's verbal abuse that maybe started with love bombing and all these things, gaslighting, is there any indication that it's going to turn verbal or physical?
I don't know if there's a specific survey, but what I can tell you is that there has been a tremendous amount of research done around high danger situations or high lethality situations for survivors, so the likelihood that you could be killed by your partner. And what we understand is that there are some commonalities in these situations where women have been murdered by their partners or there's been an attempted murder. And those commonalities could be things like your partner is extremely jealous and controlling, your partner's unemployed, you have a child that is not your partner's child. Mm-hmm. Of course, there are other key questions like your partner has strangled you or choked you that exhibit more of the physical violence or the threats of physical violence. Your partner has threatened to kill you, your partner is suicidal and has threatened to kill themselves. But what I think that that research does is it shows us that there's kind of a wide swath, you know, anywhere between about 11 and 20 indicators that we use in our work to assess somebody's danger. And we use that to educate them because some of those behaviors that we talk about often are not associated with being high danger, right? Like your partner being unemployed, you know, that somebody might go, well, why would that? Well, the research tells us your partner being unemployed, being extremely controlling and jealous, and being suicidal can be the absolute, you know, recipe for a tragedy. So we use those tools to help us understand the dangerousness, and we use that information to educate a survivor and then safety plan around their situation. Again, the one thing that is really important is these are just tools. And so although tools are helpful in those conversations, the most important thing is to be listening to a survivor about the details of their relationship and what they're experiencing and how they're feeling.
So that's the perfect tee up for my next question, which is if you know or suspect that someone you care about is experiencing domestic abuse, what's the best way to support them, to help them, to intervene? I mean, you don't want to make things worse.
Right. I think that's such a great point that you made there, Mary Beth. So most important, listen. Listen to a survivor. Listen with non-judgment. And I don't know if you two have heard about the Start by Believing campaign, but that really is a campaign around interpersonal violence, domestic violence, stalking, sexual assault. That's what we need to do as community members, as friends, as family. When somebody discloses to you, believe them. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry this is happening to you. I am concerned about your safety. Let me see what I can do to help. Right? Know what resources are in your community. You don't have to be an expert in this. That's why Peace House is here. We've been here nearly 30 years, coming upon our 30th anniversary. We have trained professional advocates that do this work every day, 24/7, right? We are here. Our lights never turn off. You, as a community member, a family member who's worried about someone, you can call our helpline and say, I'm not sure how to address this. Or someone disclosed to me yesterday, I'm not sure if I handled it right, and I want to follow up with them. What could I do? We're a resource for everyone in this community. So really start by believing, listening, knowing your resources. Don't do anything that could potentially cause or increase danger.
Don't leave the pamphlet around on the desk.
Right. So don't, you don't want to leave the resource information, you know, on the kitchen counter, right? We know that when a victim of domestic violence is leaving, that is the highest a point of risk for them because their partner starts to feel a sense of loss of control, right? So it is the most dangerous time for increased violence and abuse, the most dangerous time to be killed. So we want to make sure as well-intended, you know, community members, family, friends, that when we give people resources, we talk about how to do that safely. We make sure we don't talk about these conversations in a space their abusive partner could hear or leave information around. Don't confront their abusive partner because if they're not ready to leave, that can increase the danger for them. Mm-hmm. So know your resources, listen to them without judgment, check in with them and develop a safety plan. And Peace House can help in all of those areas.
So you can go to Peace House if you're just a supporter and get some resources to help too?
Absolutely. You can call on the helpline. You can walk through the doors during our business hours and an advocate can talk with you and share resources and give you some tips. a plan that you can take with you that will help you as you're navigating those conversations with your loved ones.
Okay, well, here's a really important one. If someone is listening to the show and they are feeling that this is a very, very familiar topic for them and a dreaded one, and they know that the tipping point has come and they want to get some help, what's the process if they were to go to Peace House, and what is available to them?
Right. So we have our 24/7 helpline is available around the clock. So again, trained professional advocates able to provide
support.
What's
that number?
It's 1-800-647-9161. And you can go to our website, peacehouse.org, as well to look at all the resources that we have available. But we have programs from safe housing, emergency shelter, transitional housing, to support services, legal advocacy, case management, counseling services, prevention education, support groups. Someone can walk up to the Peace House at any point in the time, you know, day or night, ring the doorbell if it's outside business hours, and an advocate there can provide them support as well. So there's a lot of different doorways to come through Peace House. If a friend needs to help you come along, they can come with you as well. So we want to make that as accessible as possible. Sometimes people even will reach out to us through, you know, technological spaces like social media. Sometimes those spaces may not be as safe, but we want to make sure that people can get connected to resources. We're here 24/7 in the community to ensure that at any point in time, whether it's 2 a.m. or 2 p.m., you can get help.
This has been such an important conversation. Kendra Wyckoff is our guest, the executive director of the Peace House. Kendra, thank you so much for joining us
on
the Mountain Life.
Thank you so much. Oh,
thanks.
And thanks for tuning into the Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City.